So I discovered yesterday is actually the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's famous speech. So the funny thing was is the dream I had, which is part of what I'm talking about, actually came to me about, I think it was in April. But so I have two alternate titles there. If some of you may recognize the top title, that is actually our company logo. So I thought I would start with a condensed autobiography for those who don't know me or don't know me well. I've been married to my lovely wife, Rachel, for just over 15 years. We celebrated 15 years this summer. And we have three children. So Jacob and Judah are over there, 7 and 9. My two crazy boys and my lovely, almost as crazy little daughter, Mara, who is 4. I was born in Botswana, the country above South Africa, in a town called Serowe, in March of 77. My parents, who most of you know, were in Botswana with the MCC, the Mennonite Central Committee. My dad taught construction, and my mom taught school. They were there for about 2.5 years, and I was born 3 months before they returned to Canada. My mom tells me the long plane trip home was a bit of a trial, as I'm sure you can imagine. I came across this picture yesterday. I don't know if... I have a brother, Jonas, who is 1.5 years younger than I am. And I grew up near Falkland in a community called Silver Creek. We moved to Vernon when I was 12. And I'm not sure Jonas would approve of me showing that picture, but too bad. I always enjoyed reading, and so I did well in school until grade 12, when my lack of studying and discipline started to show. I graduated in 95 and went to the Kelowna campus of Okanagan College, as it was called then, and completed my diploma in electronic engineering. It was during my first year that Rachel and I renewed a previous friendship and quickly started dating. Matt Brunell was quite surprised to see me in the mall holding hands with a girl he did not recognize. We spent the next 1.5 years apart with 2 short visits in between. My friends tell me I was occasionally grumpy during that time. When I graduated from college, I moved to Niagara Falls to continue courting Rachel, and we were married almost 1 year later. I had initially looked for work in my field of study, but quickly ran out of money and started working in a greenhouse that grew miniature potted roses, and this led to my becoming the grower for a new section, as well as maintenance and programming of the control systems, and finally as the grower for the expanded site a few years later. 5 years later, Rachel's parents and siblings moved to the States, and we decided to move to the Okanagan. We were kind of, you know, there wasn't really a lot to keep us in Niagara Falls because all her family had gone, and well, when tossing up the States and the Okanagan, it was not a hard decision. Amen. The forest industry was doing well, and the time was right for the expansion of my parents' forest nursery, and so we bought another site, and that was a little over 10 years ago. This is our 10th season this year. Jacob was born 1 month after we moved into our current home, followed 23 months later by Judah, and 3.5 years later by their sister, Mara. We grow 4 seedlings for replanting logging sites, and we produce between 2 and 3 million seedlings per year on our site. Just to give you some perspective, somewhere around 300 million seedlings are planted a year in BC. Our work is seasonal, and so we've had the opportunity to hire over 130 people during the last 10 years. Some of them have become good friends, and it's always interesting to see what God will do in their lives, Christians and non-Christians alike. When we started our business, I was quite a bit younger, and so I related primarily to our employees on a peer level. And as I became a father and grew older, I found many of the relationships have become closer to a father-child relationship. And this has definitely stirred my focus toward the fatherless young men of this next generation. I'd like to make 2 other comments that may help you understand me a little more. I'm a verbal processor, and I think extremely methodically. And this means sometimes I will come to the conclusion after much talking, and Rachel will have to wait patiently for me to come to the same conclusion she has intuitively jumped to, minutes or even hours before I have made it there. It's true. The second is that I look grumpy when I'm thinking hard about something. I can't say I'm the joyful one when choosing between Rachel and I. Rachel adds much joy to my life, as do my kids. But as I tell my employees, if I look mad, I'm not. I'm just concentrating. The The focus of this message came from a dream I had a few months ago, and I thought it might be appropriate to show you a video of another man who had a dream when he was about the same age as I am now. It also seems appropriate as it's the 50th anniversary of this speech.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
So in April, I had a dream that was very vivid, and it left me emotionally stunned for a few days. For those who know me, to leave me emotionally stunned is a fairly strong thing. I won't go into all the details, but the dream was about Rachel's and my property, which is planned for the future expansion of our business. And in my dream, I allowed people who did not carry the same long-term vision to build on and fill the empty places of the property. What each individual built was not wrong, but they left no room for the planned future expansion. And at the end of the dream, my children and others crawled out of a rocky hillside towards me. The dream spoke to me of God's generational purpose and the need for a unified long-term vision when carrying out God's plans. As my business is a long-term business, as well as a second-generation business, I've thought a lot about generational transfer in the last few years. The trees I grow will be harvested in 40 to 60 years, and in many areas of the province, they will be the third or fourth harvest in that area. Having three young children also points me towards future generations. For many of you, your children and grandchildren help give meaning and focus to generational thinking. Planning generationally is always much easier if there is a tangible shape and focus to the planning. Although I have done my best to be scripturally balanced, I'm sharing not only something I feel is relevant to this local body, but something that has also become a strong personal focus. So I'm going to make some statements that may offend some of you, but if you have questions, I will open it up after my message to try and respond to those questions, or if you prefer, please feel free to talk to me after the service. So there are 4 points I'd like to talk about. And the first is God is always thinking generationally. Galatians 4, verse 4 through 7 says, "But when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, so that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. Because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, 'Abba, Father.' Therefore, you are no longer a slave, but a son, and if a son, then an heir through God." So here we have an incredible story that summarizes beginning to end. All is and has been foreknown and planned by God. In the fullness of time, the adoption of sons, and finally an heir through God. I would like to note that Jesus is God's son, not God's brother. The Bible constantly refers to believers as sons and heirs. And just to note, sonship is not gender specific. It identifies those who are taking an active role in their inheritance. Those who have priority status with their father. Jesus illustrates this intimate relationship by teaching us to pray to God as our Father, and even more, a child's response, "Abba," often translated as "daddy." Proverbs 13:22, again, we have a generational focus. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. And again, in Psalm 33:11, the counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of his heart from generation to generation. An heir is someone who receives their allotted possession by rights of sonship. To think generation to generation, we must always be thinking of ourselves as inheritors. If we think of ourselves as an heir, we will always be thinking towards the future. We will understand what our father owns is carried for us, and what we own is carried for our heirs. In this way, we steward what God has given. But, unlike a steward who only follows the direction of the master, a son or daughter has a place of partnership, not only with future planning, but also with what the future is. In Genesis 18:13-33, this partnership with God is seen in the story of Abraham and God debating the criteria for the destruction of Sodom. I don't pretend to understand the full extent of what took place, but it stands as an example of true partnership between man and God. My second point is that God is always thinking generational expansion, and this can be separated into two parts. The first is there are natural and adopted heirs. In Jesus' time, natural heirs would have meant someone who could trace their lineage back to Abraham. I am generally using the term natural heirs to indicate someone who is related by blood. We parents tend to always focus on our natural children, and this focus would have been even stronger in Jesus' time. So we have the parable of the Good Samaritan. Well, this parable is told in Luke 10:30 as a response to a question. The question is asked by a man, the New American Standard translates as a lawyer. He is asking what he should do to inherit eternal life, and he's probably pretty sure he already knows the answer. There's a joke that says, if you're a lawyer, never ask a question you don't already know the answer to. When Jesus asks him for his opinion based on the law, he has the correct legal response ready to hand in Luke 10:27, and he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind and your neighbor as yourself." Jesus agrees, but the lawyer, not happy with Jesus' affirmation, asks a further question, "Who is my neighbor?" He probably expects a response based around immediate family, perhaps based on his tribe, maybe even going back to all who are sons of Abraham. Instead, Jesus gives an answer based on the heart expressed in action. A Samaritan, a group of people despised and hated by the Jews. Jesus' response cut across all the natural family lines of his culture. Deliberately, I might add. He's trying to broaden his listeners' viewpoint, to help them see that there is more to this neighbor thing than the tribal or blood relationship. The actions of this Samaritan showed him to be closer to the wounded man than his natural family. The Bible speaks often of our adoption into God's family, and one of the best-known verses on adoption is Romans 8:12. "So then, brethren, we are under obligation not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh, for if you are living according to the flesh, you must die. But if by the Spirit you are putting to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are being led by the Spirit of God, these are sons of God. For you have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons, by which we cry out, 'Abba, Father.' The Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God, and of children, heirs also. Heirs with God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, so that we may also be glorified with him." And the second part is that this adoption is through faith. Romans 9:30-32 says, "What shall we say then? The Gentiles, who did not pursue righteousness, attained righteousness, even the righteousness which is by faith. But Israel, pursuing a law of righteousness, did not arrive at that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as though it were by works, they stumbled over the stumbling stone." So there is a pattern given to us here of God's sovereignty and his choice of people, and that the righteousness that allows us to be part of God's family is by faith. In Hebrews 2:10-15, Christ's purpose is expressed in both in bringing many sons to glory, and in a quote from Isaiah 8:18, "Behold, I and the children who God has given me." We as Christians have been adopted into God's family as sons and daughters. As Christians, we should have a huge focus on adopted family instead of just natural family. Instead, we first group into our natural families and forget that God's family must be larger. I'd like to clarify that legal adoption is not specifically what I'm referring to. God has given some people an incredible grace to adopt and raise children who are not biologically related. Recently, Rachel's brother Andrew and his wife Strichelle were certified to foster to adopt, and this is something that quite honestly scares me. I know personally of an adoption that has given much heartbreak to the parents, and the fact of being given up for adoption is something that the adopted child has never been able to deal with. Nevertheless, whatever fostering or adoption looks like brought into my family, I must not let my fear narrow my vision to less than God's vision. Many people, including many of you, informally fostered. You have friends of your children, perhaps who refer to you as a second mom, or more rarely, their second father. Some of you, as moms and dads, were able to carry something of God's heart, and you grew true adopted sons and daughters to multiply God's kingdom. If the sons and daughters who our lives touch honestly desire and decide to be part of God's family, and we do not allow them to be part of our family, we miss the expansion of God's kingdom that he wants to bring. It's not enough for us to just mentor or disciple. Both of these are good things. But if we stop there, we stop short of Christ's mandate and call to bring many sons and daughters to the Father. A son or daughter knows they have priority status with their parents. They carry obligations and responsibilities, along with the understanding that what their parents own will be given to them as their inheritance to expand. To truly bring adopted sons and daughters to the Father requires us to give these children a true part of the family inheritance. One of the things that I have been thinking about is whether or not in Hebrew times, if a family, if there was no inheritor, if there was no heir, a steward could inherit. And so I do believe that there is an application that God gives us that that we must be always thinking not only of what our children will inherit, but whether God will bring stewards to us who maybe were not given an inheritance by their natural parents, who that we can actually bring and actually give an inheritance as part of God's family. So one of my focuses in the last few years has been the many young men and women who have worked for me. The seasonal aspect of the job and the hours of our evening shift mean many of my crew are between the ages of 17 to 21. And out of 10 young men who worked one particular night, only one had both parents together. Some had stepfathers, one lived with his grandparents. There are huge gaps in their understanding of family. If I, as a man, can speak into their lives as a father, not just as a friend or a peer, there is the opportunity for God to reveal to them a glimpse of the fatherhood of God. My understanding of them as sons and daughters to be brought to God the Father, their daddy, opens my heart to be used by God as a father. Adoption is a huge topic, and it's one that I can't even come close to expanding properly. I think I would summarize by saying God has a major focus on adoption, and that we as Christ's sons and daughters must have the same strong focus. Our focus on families must be wide enough to include those who are not part of our natural family, or we will not see the multiplication of God's kingdom he desires. My third point is that Jesus speaks of our Christian family as potentially superseding our natural family. And this is found in Mark 3:31 and Matthew as well. And in Matthew it says, while he was still speaking to the crowds, behold, his mother and brothers were standing outside seeking to speak to him. And someone said to him, behold, your mother and your brothers are standing outside seeking to speak to you. Now, there are various interpretations as to why they were standing outside. Some say they thought he was crazy and they were trying to bring him home. Apparently, there was a giant crowd and they couldn't get through to him. And so they sent someone to tell Jesus and say, we want to speak to you. And they kind of had an expectation that Jesus would drop everything. And stretching out his hand towards his disciples, he says, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he is my brother and sisters, and mother. Now, this would have been just as shocking to his listeners then as it is for many now. As in many countries today, allegiance, identity, and belonging was along tribal lines. My parents were in Africa for a few years, and that's just the way it is. And we see that in many of the elections that are being held in different countries even today. Jewish law relating to parents was the fifth commandment. Honor your father and mother so your days may be long in the land that God has given you. And what Jesus said went completely against the cultural understanding of family hierarchy. It declares our first connection and allegiance is centered on Christ. Our priority in our relationships comes out of that understanding. Not only was this a radical departure then, for many it is a radical departure today. Paul often addresses his letters to his dear brothers and sisters. 1 Corinthians 15:50 and 58 is a specific example. This was not simply because he couldn't remember the names of those he was writing to, although I have trouble remembering people's names, maybe I could use that. It was a deliberate statement of family belonging. If we focus only on our natural families, we miss the larger picture that Christ calls us to. I've heard people say, and I've probably said myself, I'm sorry I can't help you, my family comes first. Well, this sounds wonderful, but let me put it in a different context. Suppose I said to my second son, Jude, I'm sorry, Jude, I can't help you, Jacob comes first. Well, we automatically feel it would be wrong to do this to our natural children. We don't feel they must be treated the same, as they're different people, but we know they have equal importance, in spite of their differences. And we must also remember that Jesus calls us his sons and daughters. And so if that is our relation, if that is his relationship to us, it also gives us our relationship to each other. This does not remove the obligations to our natural families, but places a priority before us. Jesus later places the care for his mother in the hands of one of his disciples in John 19:25 through 27. In Mark 7:8 through 13, he chastises the Pharisees and calls them hypocrites for leaving loopholes so a son could avoid taking care of his parents. Many other verses refer to our responsibilities to our families. But this priority between believers is also stated again in Galatians 6:9-10. It says, let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we will reap if we do not grow weary. So then, while we have the opportunity, let us do good to all people, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. The word household indicates those who came under the family covering. This is a statement of place and identity, authority and care, responsibility and priority. My last point is that we have an unlimited inheritance to share. Because Christ's inheritance to us is unlimited, we have an unlimited inheritance to pass on. This is important because expansion always requires growth. There was an interesting example of the opposite attitude in pre-20th century England, and this was a custom called entailment. An entail specified that the whole estate went to the nearest male relative. And there are many subtleties to an entailment, many details of it. But the intent was that the estate was kept intact and passed to the eldest male heir. Your place in society and your power were determined by how much land you owned. Land gave both money and status, and so dividing your land between even two sons would decrease their status and position and ultimately fracture an estate. A quote from one of my favorite authors, Ellis Peters, in a short story called Tallboys talks about this dilemma. And one character says, I much prefer the French custom of dividing properly evenly because it's so much better for the children. And Harriet replies, but it's very bad for property. Now, this is very true. What the law responded to is the reality of dividing up an estate. So we could call it a law based on experience. But if we have a limited view of our inheritance, we will respond in the same way. I can't split the inheritance up. Everybody won't have enough. One of the fears that prevents us from being enthusiastic about full adoption is we don't believe there's a large enough inheritance. If we have too many children, either natural or adopted, we believe they won't receive enough, that we don't have enough to give to them all. In Ezekiel 47:21-23, God speaks about an inheritance for those who are not part of the tribes of Israel. So you should divide this land up among yourselves according to the tribes of Israel. You should divide it by lot for an inheritance among yourselves. We've heard that part before. And among the aliens who stay in your midst, who bring forth sons in your midst, and they shall be to you as the native-born among the sons of Israel. They shall be allotted an inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel. And in the tribe with which the alien stays, there shall you give him an inheritance, declares the Lord God. For the Israelites to embrace this verse, they had to believe that what God had given them was enough to be shared as an inheritance. There's also so much in this verse about the expansion of God's purpose and adoption. That's what's taking place here. The aliens, those not part of the 12 tribes, receive an inheritance. That's us. Wonderful. Even here before Romans 8, God is a God of adoption. In Jewish law, in contrast to Old English law, the eldest inherited a double portion. The heirs were expected to expand what they received to supply not only their present household, but the growth of their families in the future. It takes faith to look at a natural lack, and by faith, see the excess. In the beginning was God. He created something out of nothing. We have access to unlimited resources. Ephesians 1:11 says, "Also we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to his purpose, who works all things after the counsel of his will. I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened, so you will know what is the hope of his calling, what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints, and what is the surpassing greatness of his power towards us who believe." So we steward our children, both natural and adopted, to receive out of God's unlimited resource. This is why we as Gentiles can be part of God's chosen people through adoption. God is big enough to fit us into his kingdom plan. He is not limited by resources. God is looking for heirs to take dominion over what he has already given. The fields are ripe for the harvest. Pray for the workers for the harvest. God is not lacking fields to give us. To change our limited mentality requires we first move from servants or stewards who don't understand what the master is doing, to disciples who pattern themselves after the master, and to heirs, sons and daughters, who have a revelation that their call is to expand their father's kingdom as an owner of the same kingdom. I saw a small step in creating ownership one Sunday morning. I had my son Jacob help me with turning on part of the sound system the previous week, and I showed him where the power button was, and he turned it on by himself, and he enjoyed that. And the next Sunday he was with me, I turned on the power myself, and I remember his disappointment when he asked if he could turn the amplifiers on, and I told him I already had. If I want to develop him as a son, I must give him true responsibility and ownership, even if it means watching him make mistakes. If I do not give real responsibility and ownership, I will raise stewards and servants. These are great actions, but they are never meant to become our identity. An heir in God's kingdom should serve, but they are not a servant. An heir in God's kingdom should steward, but we are not a steward. An heir is an owner. If we stop before ownership, we stop short of God's plan for us. We need the obedience of a servant and the passion of a son, who grows into a father, who creates sons. Thank you.